All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral Wong Peach presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Coral Wong Peach, and I'm joined by Judge Toth to my right, Judge Jaquith to my left. We are convened today to consider the arguments in the matter of Mai DeHart versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 21-6249. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for our record? Thank you.
Colin Rantamel and Chris Wallace, Court Secretary.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay, fine, thank you. Okay, why don't we go ahead, counsel for the appellant.
May it please the court. When VA granted Air Force veteran DeHart separate ratings for radiculopathy in 2019, the RO told her it was a partial decision on the issue of an increased evaluation for her service-connected back condition. So the RO recognized that radiculopathy was part of her increased rating for a back disability appeal. This was correct, and so Mr. Hart did not need to appeal the 2019 decision because it was already before the board by virtue of her February 2009 notice of disagreement. Accordingly, the court should hold.
Excuse me, counsel, which date was the disagreement on?
The notice of disagreement was from February of 2009.
Okay, thank you.
Accordingly, the court should hold that the board had jurisdiction over Mr. Hart's radiculopathy ratings and remand for the board to consider whether she was entitled to a separate rating for radiculopathy prior to March of 2019.
Was there anything about that NOD or any of the veterans' pleadings that put the board on notice that this was part of what they were reviewing?
The board was on notice that the radiculopathy was part of what they were reviewing in the increased rating for the back claim, because the regulation directs adjudicators to consider neurological manifestations and to assign a separate rating appropriately. When Mr. Hart appealed her initial rating decision for the back disability, she said, "Lumbar spondylolisthesis grade 2, I'm having severe problems with this condition and it should be evaluated higher." And so because the regulation recognizes that part of rating a back disability may also include neurological manifestations, and because there was evidence of neurological manifestations of that back disability in the record, the adjudicator was on notice that that was part of what should have been rated at that time.
Isn't it, I mean, the way I understand Ross and the way it sort of breaks it out is an increased rating is when a condition worsens, right? I mean, that's the language they use. Whereas a different claim or an additional condition is something that's different, you know, from a sort of worsening of a condition. And I guess the way you would differentiate those two is one would be rated within a diagnostic code, right? So it would, the condition would worsen and you'd go from 50 to 100. Whereas another takes you out of a diagnostic code to a different one. I mean, what would you say about that? Because there's no claim here that the radiculopathy got a higher back rating. It's a separate rating under a different diagnostic code, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But the key here is that the diagnostic code for the back disability, note one directs adjudicators in rating the back disability to consider whether or not there are neurological manifestations and to rate under the appropriate diagnostic code.
Right. I mean, I understand that it could be something like you don't have to file a separate claim for radiculopathy if you have a back claim because it'll be among the things that an adjudicator will have a duty to consider, right? That doesn't automatically mean it's the same claim, right? I'm thinking of the case Godinez that has a lot about how to distinguish a secondary condition from a primary condition.
Your Honor, I believe that this case is not governed by Godinez because this is not a secondary service connection issue. This is when the board assigned Ms. DeHart the separate ratings, it was a separate rating because that condition is, I believe the language from Bailey, is logically related to the initial condition that is the subject of the initial disability.
Sure, but I mean, the note, these conditions can be so closely related always that it might warrant a note, just a note to adjudicators, that these are so commonly related that it's almost guaranteed that if it manifests, that it'll be something like a secondary condition. I guess I'm having a hard time kind of making the additional leap that this would now put it as part of the primary condition.
It's not. Ms. DeHart is in receipt of the rating under the lumbar diagnostic code. And then in addition to that, she receives a separate rating for the radiculopathy. So it's not as if the lumbar diagnostic code subsumes the radiculopathy rating. It's that in attempting to make sure that this veteran is appropriately rated, that her benefits adequately compensate her for her disabilities, she receives a rating under both diagnostic codes.
But how can it be separate for rating purposes and part of for adjudication?
The separate rating is simply the vehicle which the VA uses to ensure that Ms. DeHart is being appropriately compensated.
But that was almost 10 years apart.
Yes, Your Honor. And Ms. DeHart had consistently appealed the rating that she was assigned for her back disability, which included the radiculopathy. Just because the VA did not until 2019 appropriately, and I would say not even appropriately because it's still not a total grant of benefits, recognize that radiculopathy was part of that claim, the record had raised that there was evidence of radiculopathy throughout the entire period on appeal. So had the RO or whatever adjudicator it was properly rated Ms. DeHart, that would have included radiculopathy ratings for the time period in which that was raised by the record.
I mean, it's clear that if the RO hadn't addressed the radiculopathy, you might be in a better situation in that it would be clearly the failure to address a reasonably raised issue. The question is really if it travels, I mean, if this... I mean, that would be something on an NOD. I mean, absolutely, with no NOD, you could appeal. The question would be then, is the NOD question, whether the RO addressed it, so there's no failure to address the radiculopathy. The question is that if that automatically kind of places it into an appellate status so that you can challenge the effective date.
So... I believe that the original February 2009 Notice of Disagreement placed the issue into appellate status. When the regional office granted the separate ratings in 2019, they only granted the separate ratings effective of, I believe, March of 2019. So that was not a total grant. And this is a similar situation to Harper, wherein there was a partial grant by the regional office, but that did not divest the board of jurisdiction of the issue.
I mean, Harper is a TDIU case, right? I mean, TDIU is always, it's basically attempting to get somebody 100% rating for that exact, for the primary condition. TDIU doesn't take you to a different diagnostic code and have a 10 and a 30 and a 50%.
Yes, Your Honor, but like TDIU, awarding separate ratings for the radiculopathy is simply an attempt to ensure that the veteran is being appropriately compensated for her disability.
Are there other kinds of cases where complications from particular disabilities are deemed part and parcel of the disability claimed?
Your Honor, similarly to the lumbar spine diagnostic code, the diagnostic code for diabetes does also direct adjudicators to consider diabetic residuals. So I would say that that is analogous to the diagnostic code that we're currently dealing with.
Like neuropathy.
Exactly, Your
but,
Honor.
But is there any case like Chavez that connects the two as in TDIU as part and parcel of the claim?
Your Honor, not as part and parcel, but I believe you reached the same result through application of 3.155D2, because in both situations, the radiculopathy and in the example, you know, any neurological manifestations of a diabetic disability are all complications of that initial disability. And again, 3.155D2 also directs adjudicators to adjudicate entitlement to any additional benefits for complications, whether or not explicitly asserted in the claim. So that would also direct the adjudicator to consider those complications.
Did anywhere along the line, the appellant, Ms. DeHart, okay, let me just see if I have my facts straight.
Mm-hmm.
In December of 2008, she was service-connected for back. And I'm just going to talk about the back.
Mm-hmm.
And 0%. Then she filed a notice of disagreement requesting an increase in her rating from 0 to higher. Then she had some back examinations. Then the statement of the case came out, continuing the 0. Then in April of 2010, she appealed to the board. Now, anywhere along that line, did she say, but what about my radiculopathy?
No, Your Honor. She simply asked for a higher rating for her lumbar spine disability and again asserted that she's having severe problems with this condition and it should be evaluated higher.
And then in January of 2014, she had a PTSD exam. She had an exam in April of 2016 for her back. And then at that point, I think she got an increase in rating of 10%. And then the board remanded the back condition, but what did they, was that as a result of an appeal or how did that get remanded?
That was still the initial appeal that Mr. Hart had filed. Because that was the first time that the board had considered the issue. So even though she had received, that intervening rating decision, again, because it was not a full grant of benefits, it was only a partial grant of benefits. And so the issue remained before the board.
Okay. And then in September of 2019, the RO increases the back condition and then gives service connection for radiculopathy.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And there was never, did the appellant file any appeal or notice or anything on that?
No, Your Honor, and it's our contention that she did not have to.
Okay.
So what do you make of Grantham? Right? Grantham's the case that basically appealing an upstream issue doesn't automatically place the downstream issues into appellate status. And I mean, that applies whether it's one claim or multiple claims or however they're related. what's your take on Grantham? Because, I mean, this fundamentally is about an effective date.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I don't believe that this is an effective date issue. What is at issue here is ensuring that Mr. Hart is appropriately rated for the period prior to 2019. And that is not an effective date question. That is evaluating the rating that she has already been assigned for the period prior to 2019 and determining whether or not it is adequate.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the radiculopathy rating,
yes.
not the back rating, right?
The radiculopathy rating, yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry, did I miss
right, but how, I'm failing to see how, I mean, that strikes me as a classic effective date determination. If you're saying, well, it's about if it's properly rated before this date, right? I mean, that's basically a challenge to the effective date.
Your Honor, again, we would respectfully disagree because, again, the adjudicator had been directed to and should have considered the neurological manifestations prior to 2019. And indeed, the record contained evidence which raised the presence of neurological manifestations. It's not an effective date issue. It's simply ensuring that Mr. Hart's rating prior to 2019 appropriately compensates all of her disability. And because it did not, we would argue that the appropriate course of action would have been for the board to consider whether she was entitled to a rating for radiculopathy during that earlier period. And yes, it is during the earlier period, but it is not an earlier effective date question. It is a question of what is the appropriate rating during that period.
Are there meaningful differences between Ms. DeHart's case and Jabez?
We don't think that there is, Your Honor. Both in Ms. DeHart's case and in Mr. Chavez's case, the board remanded the issue, and that is what prompted the RO to consider and award separate ratings for radiculopathy. In Mr. Chavez's case, I will note that the board had explicitly remanded the issue of radiculopathy, and the board did not do that in Mr. Hart's case. However, in Mr. Hart's case, by remanding the increased rating for the back, the board also necessarily remanded the potential for radiculopathy ratings because they were part of the back rating. So in that regard, there is no significant factual difference between this case and Chavez.
Are there possible unintended consequences of embracing the Chavez board's characterization of radiculopathy as part and parcel of a spine disability?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. You know, as with any issue that the board considers, this is something that the board would be required to consider if it's raised by the record. So I think we'd be in a different situation altogether if there was no evidence of radiculopathy. But in cases like here, where there is radiculopathy raised by the record, application of the Chavez court's reasoning would simply ensure that these veterans are appropriately evaluated for their back disability, even if that means assigning a separate rating for radiculopathy that is separate.
So there's no worry of that denial of service connection for a spine disability would foreclose a radiculopathy claim?
Your Honor, I think that again would be a factual analysis that would depend on the facts of that particular case. I don't think that it would whole cloth preclude any radiculopathy ratings. But again, sir, I think that's a factual inquiry, and I don't think the court needs to reach that question today.
Does anything change based on the fact that the matter was sort of automatically returned to the board? I mean, is that relevant at all? And I guess what I'm thinking about is, I guess there's sort of notice implications, right? I mean, I mean, your client received notice that of the radiculopathy rating, and did she receive appellate rights? And then basically, because, you know, obviously the back's going back up, you don't have to file anything, you don't have to do it, you don't have to do a single thing. Was there any notice that this is a, you know, the separate claim, here's that you would challenge this, et cetera, et cetera?
Nothing in the rating decision would have led Ms. DeHart to believe that this was a, you know, a separate issue that she needed to separately appeal.
Sure. Well, sometimes, I mean, I don't know how it works. Do they just attach an appellate rights form?
Yes, Your Honor. The rating decision that Ms. DeHart received was essentially standard with the typical notice of action letter and appellate rights. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Yes, please. Okay. We'll add 1 minute.
For the foregoing reasons, Mr. Hart respectfully requests that the court remand for the board to consider radiculopathy ratings for the period prior to 2019. In addition, although we did not discuss today, Mr. Hart would also request that the court remand entitlement to a rating in excess of 10% for the period prior to 2019 and in excess of 10% thereafter for the back disability because the board relied on insufficient medical information and failed to fully account for all evidence of functional loss. Additionally, the court should also remand entitlement to a rating in excess of 50% for PTSD for the board to properly apply the regulation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This court should reaffirm longstanding law that separate and distinct disabilities must be treated separately for appellate purposes. In doing so, the court should hold that a claim for benefits for radiculopathy is not necessarily part and parcel of a claim for benefits for a spine condition.
So what's the longstanding, I mean, I understand the law, but what's the case?
Well, Your Honor, there are several cases that expand on the idea that separate and distinct disabilities need to be treated separately. Going back to the Federal Circuit's decision in Boggs v. Peek, which made that as sort of a general statement, this court continued on that reasoning in Godinez v. McDonough.
Well, yeah, no, that's definitely the case. But I guess the question is what's separate, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're trying to figure out is what makes something part and parcel of one claim versus an additional disability that might spill out somewhere else.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it's important to note in the discussion of note one to the general rating formula under diseases of the spine and 38 CFR 3.155D2, that there is an important distinction between the secretary's obligation to develop and adjudicate claims and what happens to those claims once the secretary has decided them. This is the directive of 38 USC 7105A. This is the statutory principle regarding the appellate process that a claimant file an NOD identifying a claim in order to place it into appellate status. 38.
Let's stop you there because I think it's a good place to stop for a second. So, because I see sort of an overlap of a couple of different concepts, right? Because I mean, Chavis, one way to read it is it's based on a kind of claim construction rationale, which is you look at a pleading, and then you figure out what the words mean, and then you figure out how broadly you know, those should be read, right? Especially, I don't know if it was pro se, but, you know, they mentioned the rule of lenity, for example. So there's claim construction. And then there's what you just mentioned, which is something like the duty to assist, right? All of the things that would be attendant and that would be kind of rolled up, you know, in the duties. And then there's basically what a claim just intrinsically, like the scope of an actual claim might be. Those are three different. They're all kind of mashed up in this case. At least, you know, we're trying to sort out which. I want to ask about the last of those three, right? So we've got, you know, VA has a lot of different things to adjudicate. But from the one level, what kind of goes up to the NOD level is really just the claim itself, right? I mean, that seems to be, you know, consistent throughout the case law. The question is what's the claim? You know, how many of those things that you mentioned that get rolled up are actually like part of the claim itself?
Yes, Your Honor. So, and I think that there's another important point to address there, which is when we talk about claim, what that means. This court in Rice was careful to explain that there's been a fairly inconsistent use of the term claim. And I think it's very relevant here because claim has been used to mean the application for benefits. That is, an appellant says, I have a back disability. That has been termed a claim, even though, as the Rice Court noted, it's best construed as an application for benefits. And then there is the claim, which is a request for benefits for a specific condition itself. And I think the Rice Court did a good job of explaining the difference between the two, and that an application for benefits may necessarily encompass many different claims for benefits. And so when we talk about the scope of a claim, there's the scope of the application that an appellant makes, and that is what specific disabilities VA is required to develop and adjudicate, regardless of whether or not they're explicitly listed.
I mean, should we, is this a terminology? Like, should we just use a different term of art, scope of adjudication, something?
I think that the Rice Court sort of chided itself and all of us practitioners on the fluid use of the term claim. I think that, as I understand Rice, I think it does a good job of highlighting the difference between the application for benefits and the claims themselves, which are the specific request for compensation for a specific disability.
Right.
Please go on. The concept is broader than that, right? I mean, it includes things that are reasonably raised by the record. Doesn't that apply here? Wasn't radiculopathy reasonably raised by the record?
Yes, Your Honor. And there are many different ways in which VA has an obligation to develop and adjudicate claims. But that brings us back to the distinction between what VA must adjudicate and how an appellant places a claim in appellate status once it has been decided by the AOJ.
Well, yeah, no, let's stay here because I mean, this is really important. I've been trying to wrap my head around this as well, which is, so TDIU, right, is part and parcel of a claim, right? So it falls within the,
yes.
Claim properly used, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's because it gets you 100% rating, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What about something like SMC?
Your Honor, I believe that SMC would be the same as TDIU in that, as opposed to really a standalone claim for benefits, which can be made regardless of whether there are other service-connected benefits for that veteran.
So
their efforts.
Am I on the right track that maybe identifying a claim is basically something that can be rated by a discrete diagnostic code? I mean, is that?
Yes, Your Honor. Right? That is.
Otherwise, it would be if it could be rated by two at the same time. You've got a pyramiding issue.
That is, generally speaking, the way in which the Secretary has designed disabilities to be compensable. There are certainly unique issues regarding rating by analogy or diagnostic codes that there are disabilities that are explicitly encompassed within numerous diagnostic codes. For instance, there are certain joint disabilities that are explicitly noted to be rateable under multiple codes at once.
But in those cases, right, you would go by analogy to somewhere else and then you would kind of return, right, with the...
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm only highlighting those to say that they are sort of an exception to the general concept that the Secretary has identified what disabilities are compensable, even if they stem from a larger disease process. So an appellant may have a back condition, and that larger disease process may manifest in multiple disabilities, such as a limitation of flexion or radiculopathy. But the Secretary has designed those specifically to be separately compensable disabilities, which I think is particularly evident in looking at radiculopathy, because it was originally, I believe prior to 2003, part of the rating code for a spine disability. It had a slightly different name than radiculopathy, but that is where that form of neuropathy was listed. The Secretary amended that diagnostic code to acknowledge that radiculopathy is a separate compensable condition, as opposed to simply symptoms of a spine condition. They may both be related to the larger disease process, but that may be true in many different ways. It's possible that an appellant could have a back disability that manifests in a spine, disability for limitation of motion, and radiculopathy, and possibly an ankle disability because it results in an antalgic gait. And that ankle disability could in turn be the proximate cause of depressive disorder. But these are not all part of the same claim simply because they stem from the same disease process. That is, the same larger issue proximately results in all of these different disabilities. The disabilities themselves remain separate issues. And that goes back to the logic of Godinus, where this court, while it's not exactly these circumstances, I think the logic carries well, where the court cautioned that separate secondary issues are not an effort to obtain a higher rating for the original condition. Rather, they are separate and distinct claims and remain subject to the requirements of 7105A that Congress put in place for identifying claims to be put into appellate status.
What about Chavez? Isn't it nearly exactly these circumstances?
Your Honor, Chavez is difficult to reconcile with the Federal Circuit's law in Grantham and in Vargas-Gonzalez, explaining that an NOD cannot decide or cannot place an undecided issue into appellate status, and particularly cannot place an unadjudicated downstream issue into appellate status. The Chavez decision
forecloses, maybe Chavez is invalid, but as it stands, Chavez forecloses that NOD argument.
Well, Your Honor, the Secretary believes that the Chavez decision was limited to the unique circumstances of that specific case. I have multiple points throughout the decision. The court highlighted that its reasoning hinged on the unique facts and circumstances of Mr. Chavez's case and cautioned that the decision was not intended for broad application. At its core, I believe that the Chavez decision is about equity. As the Secretary acknowledged, in either his motion for reconsideration or his supplemental memorandum of law following oral argument, VA provided misleading notices to Mr. Chavez. However, we have law that is intended to remedy those situations. There is law for when VA fails to provide an adequate notice or for when VA provides a misleading notice that an appellant detrimentally relies on. The Secretary maintains that that is how Chavez should have been intended or should have been decided if it were intended to apply broadly, because that law is well settled. Instead, the Chavez court issued a highly factually driven decision that it purposefully limited to those unique facts.
What strikes me, in Hall, we sort of chipped away at the kind of jurisdictional nature of NODs. I know we said the form's not jurisdictional, even the timing may not be jurisdictional. Whereas Chavez is definitely premised on the idea that an NOD is jurisdictional. So anything, if the board were to address it, it's ultra vires. Whatever it is, I mean, an NOD is definitely the triggering event that there's no duty for VA to adjudicate anything unless there's a filing of an NOD. That said, I mean, if it's not jurisdictional and they basically just gratuitously granted something, it's like a favorable finding. But I think without that jurisdictional question, I think it's much easier question to answer of what happened in Chavez, which is, okay, they made a favorable ruling. Maybe that they didn't have to. Maybe it's that simple in that case. Because I know that, the three rationales they give, the first is basically, it's like the facts. The second are basically how to read, like, the form of the NOD, how to read the language of the NOD. So I don't know if you can speak to that, just about the kind of jurisdictional implications of an NOD.
Yes, Your Honor. So the Secretary maintains that there is nothing in the law that obviates the requirement for an NOD as a jurisdictional document under 7105A. The form itself is a process, claims processing rule,
sure,
as opposed to a jurisdictional rule. But an appellant still must show some intent to place a claim into appellate status. As occurred here, VA provided a notice of the decision and a notice of appellate rights. Appellant has never raised any notice error or any argument as to notice. The appellant simply did not respond.
But there is a jurisdiction conferring NOD. The question is its scope, not whether one exists.
Yes, Your Honor. There is an NOD. The Secretary's position is that that NOD cannot pertain to the separate issue of radiculopathy, which had neither been adjudicated nor granted at the time the NOD was filed. The Secretary believed that goes back to Grantham and Vargas.
Chavez answers that question against you.
Chavez answers that. I
mean, the facts, sure. There's a footnote that says we're talking about these facts, but there's nothing about that addresses the question that you want to make, the whether there was no jurisdiction because there was no applicable NOD was raised and rejected by the Chavez majority. That was the subject of Judge Meredith's entire dissent.
Yes, Your Honor, but it was rejected as to the facts and circumstances of that case, which are, as the majority noted, unique, not only primarily because of VA's treatment of the claim as being in appellate status and VA's providing misleading notices throughout the life of the claim. That's not the case here.
And although the board didn't act like it had no jurisdiction over the RO's decision in this case, it discussed the RO's decision in its decision.
Yes, Your Honor. The board's discussion here was somewhat circumspect, I believe read in the context of the decision where the board declined to address anything other than noting that the RO had made a grant, shows that the board did not intend to take jurisdiction or believe that it could take jurisdiction over that issue.
That's reading a lot into inaction. They said nothing of the sort.
Yes, Your Honor, but if the board had believed it was in appellate status, it's reasonable to believe that the board would have done something other than simply note the existence of a rating decision.
Your point is, jurisdictional or not, there's no forfeiture, right? I mean, they could, when you adjudicate something, I mean, you would forfeit whatever right you would have to dismiss it or not adjudicate it, right? I mean, that never happened in this case. There's no adjudication. There's no board adjudication as to the radiculopathy.
Correct, Your Honor. The secretary maintains that the treatment of these separate disabilities as separate claims is not only consistent with the law, but is in fact the most fair method of approaching the disabilities that protects the rights of
I want to ask about that because I want to ask sort of a variant of what I asked opposing counsel, which is about reliance, right? Because, I could see an unwary claimant sort of think, oh, well, it's automatically going to go back to the board. So it's not immediately obvious that you'd have to, oh, well, this half of the decision I have to file a separate NOD on. What about that, like, just kind of general reliance on the fact that it's all going back anyway?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the rating decision that Mr. Hart received here, nor that would be in a standard rating decision or notice of appellate rights, that would indicate that a new decision would automatically return to the board. The RO noted that this was a new grant of benefits and provided a notice of appellate rights. That's nothing more than what we would expect from a claimant in any other situation, which is to respond showing some intent to challenge that ruling. This is different from Chavez, where the RO had provided multiple notices that would reasonably mislead the claimant into believing his radiculopathy claim was in appellate status.
So like in a normal case, let's say, I hesitate to kind of do this, make you do this on your feet, but it's helpful. So if a person's challenging just generic service connection to the board, the board says, okay, we'll grant, the RO erred, there was nexus, so we'll grant service connection, and then we send it back to the RO to do the effective date, assign a rating.
Yes, sir.
When the RO assigns the, in our hypothetical here, when they assign a rating and effective date, that doesn't automatically go back. Person would have to file an NOD as to those kind of, what are the downstream issues? Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Those downstream issues, the RO can make the initial assignment, a of a rating, and effective date is part of its decision. But those downstream issues require an NOD to place them into appellate status if the appellant wishes to challenge them. And
the effective date's not a downstream issue, though, here, is it? It's right in the stream. The rating and the effective date are right in the RO's decision and right in the board's decision.
No, you're
right. It's not like it's been adjudicated in stages.
The RO provided that as part of its initial grant of service connection. The board did not make any determination on those issues. The board simply noted what the RO had done. I want to highlight that it's important. What happened here is what would normally happen with separate and distinct claims. The RO provides a notice of the decision, notice of appellate rights, how to engage those rights, and when an appellant may provide evidence or argument. Under appellant's reading of the law, the board could simply take jurisdiction over an unadjudicated downstream issue and reach a final decision on it without the appellant understanding that it was in appellate status or having an opportunity to submit evidence or argument in support of that claim. Those are the hallmarks of fair process. It is notice and an opportunity to be heard. If the board could simply take jurisdiction over an unadjudicated issue and reach a final decision without the appellant ever having notice or an opportunity to respond, that clearly implicates fair process. More than that, it also implicates an appellant's statutory right to one review on appeal before the secretary and one review before the board. If the board were to decide an issue in the first instance that an appellant had never had adjudicated at the AOJ level, this potentially infringes on their recognized statutory right to have the AOJ review a decision before the board.
But that's not what happened here. It was adjudicated at the AOJ level. The ridiculopathy.
Correct, Your Honor. And yet it was adjudicated initially at the AOJ level here. But the appellant...
So wasn't the board obliged to engage with the evidence more than just describe the AOJ's action?
No, Your Honor. Again, because there was no jurisdiction conferring NOD and no intent ever shown by the appellant to challenge the AOJ's initial decision. If the board had simply... That decision...
How is that fact distinct from what happened in Chavez?
That fact is distinct from
these other circumstances. How is
Chavez, again, because Chavez was limited by the court to the facts and circumstances of that case, which included the misleading
decision. That reads a lot into the court's footnote. A lot.
It's not simply the footnote, Your Honor. Throughout the decision, the court reiterated that its holding was based on the circumstances of this case and that under these...
But they cited what those circumstances were, and they didn't have to do with misleading notice. They had to do with the evidence of the ridiculopathy in the record and the nature of the VA's duties to liberally construe the claim, their adjudication procedures manual, note one to the regulation, all those circumstances.
And they also discussed VA's treatment of the claim as being in appellate status throughout its life.
Well, they treated it as being in appellate status. Well, they treated it as being in appellate status here too. That's what happened when RO adjudicated the claim.
No, Your Honor, the RO made an initial adjudication. This is different from Chavez, where the RO in, I believe it was both the statement of the case and then the board in its decision explicitly noted ridiculopathy in a manner that would lead the appellant to believe it was in appellate status. That is distinct from what the RO and the board did in this circumstance.
I know in Chavez, we made a big deal out of the fact that he included in the NOD something about his claim in all aspects, right? And I think that was kind of central to the rationale, this in all aspects as kind of informing the scope of the pleading such that kind of included the ridiculopathy. Is that relevant here? I mean, does that inform how we should look at this?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think at best that language works in tandem with a misleading notice, where VA may have suggested that radiculopathy was on consideration, and then the appellant makes a broader reference to all aspects. That could show detrimental reliance on VA's misleading notice. But the Federal Circuit made clear in Grantham and Vargas Gonzalez that an unadjudicated downstream issue cannot be placed into appellate status. And so simply including broad language cannot add an undecided issue to an NOD.
In this case, the effective date of the back was never in question, right? Because it was, if I remember correctly, service connection was granted as of the date the claim was filed.
Yes, for the spine spondylolisthesis.
Excuse me, the spine, right. It was never in question.
No, that issue was not in question. I believe appellant's claim was to challenge the rating for the spine condition.
Okay. I hate to do this again, but I'm going to make you kind of think on your feet. I mean, hypothetically, if they'd done a stage rating, say, if they had increased it and said, well, okay, we'll give you an effect, you know, we'll increase your rating, but it's sometime during the claims period, I don't know, 2013 or something. If you're reading of the NOD, would that have been a downstream issue that would have gone in? Is that something that they would have necessarily had to file a separate NOD for, or might that have been included in the claim?
If I understand you right, Your Honor, you're saying if the RO had provided a stage rating for the spine claim?
Yeah, as I understand, the NOD basically just challenged the rating.
Yes.
Right? She's been continuously seeking a higher rating, right? And then if I'm reading Grantham correctly, ratings and effective dates are different things. The effective date would necessarily be downstream. Here, the effective date wasn't challenged because it was basically the date the claim was filed. And so the kind of hypothetical I'm asking is, what happens if maybe there had been an effective date issue?
I think that goes to what the NOD itself looks like. This is a separate, well-settled area of law regarding the fact that a generalized NOD is sufficient to place all decided issues into appellate status, and that the secretary has an obligation to sympathetically read any filing made by a pro se claimant. And so if the RO had issued a decision that provided a staged rating, if it had potentially implicated both rating and effective date, and an unrepresented appellant had provided a generalized NOD that VA would sympathetically construe as placing every issue decided in that rating decision into appellate status, then yes, that would give the board jurisdiction to consider the effective date and the rating as to that spine issue, because the NOD would reasonably be construed as conferring jurisdiction over the issues decided by the AOJ.
Could I ask you to speak to your M21 manual? Can you tell me what you think it says with respect to this issue of having radiculopathy part of a spinal condition?
Yes, Your Honor. So the Secretary believes that the M21 provision is meant to mirror Note 1 under diseases of the spine. The purpose of this being to ensure that when there is an application for benefits for a spine disability, whether that's an initial application or for an increased rating, that VA review the medical evidence, and if there is evidence of an associated neurological condition, to rate it, evaluate it separately under the diagnostic code. That is to create a separate claim and adjudicate that claim initially, regardless of whether it was formally requested by the appellant. This is a protection that is in place due to the Secretary's recognition that neurological disabilities and spinal disabilities are often related. As the dissent in Chavez noted, there is nothing in Note 1 that speaks to what happens once the Secretary has done this, once the Secretary has separately considered and adjudicated a neurological condition. There's certainly nothing in the plain reading of Note 1 that could obviate the statutory requirement for an NOD once that initial adjudication.
But prior to that, is that what happened in this case? Was there not evidence of radiculopathy and as well as the spinal conditions, so that M21 would have kicked in and made the...
That's certainly a fair argument, Your Honor. But that, again, under the Federal Circuit's binding precedent in Grantham Vargas Gonzalez, that would not allow the unadjudicated issue of service connection for radiculopathy to move into appellate status. What it would do is provide an argument for the appellant that would protect that effective date. So if the appellant had responded to the notice of appellate rights and challenged the effective date assigned with the grant of radiculopathy, appellant could have argued that VA erred by failing to earlier adjudicate entitlement to radiculopathy as required by the general rating schedule. That evidence of a claim within 1 year of the date of diagnosis could protect an earlier effective date. But again, appellant would need to have shown some intent and provided something that could confer jurisdiction in order for the board to be able to consider that argument.
And our appellant is saying that's unnecessary because that radiculopathy is automatically should have been and is part of the back condition. Is that my understanding of that argument?
That's my understanding of that position as well, Your Honor. The secretary believes that this confuses the secretary of the VA's obligations as far as the initial application of benefits, what VA is obligated to automatically develop and adjudicate, as opposed to the steps necessary to place that issue into appellate status.
So we're not talking about appellate status, but why wouldn't the VA have considered the evidence of radiculopathy within the claim of the back injury? I'm not talking about for purposes of appeal, but I mean just for purposes of processing that claim.
Yes, Your Honor, and I see that my time is about to expire. If I may respond.
Five more minutes? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that would simply be an error in the processing of the initial claim. There is no procedural or administrative reason as to why VA would have chosen not to consider entitlement to radiculopathy, particularly where Note 1 directs adjudicators to do so. That would simply be an error on VA's part. But even if that created an unadjudicated open claim for radiculopathy as of that date, that still would do nothing in this instance to confer jurisdiction over downstream issues.
It's almost a paradox. I mean, I mentioned this to opposing counsel, right? Is if the RO had never addressed it, then on appeal, it's an appellate status because there would have been a failure to satisfy the duty to assist, right? Just vis-a-vis the spine claim, right? Which is you had Note 1 told you to look at a radiculopathy. It's there.
The secretary's
right.
But
actually, by granting the claim, it then basically triggered the requirement of an NOD to sort of trigger the duty for DA to have to adjudicate it, right? That's
yes,
the paradox.
But the secretary's position is that the board would have had the ability to consider entitlement to radiculopathy. If there had been no intervening decision here, the board would not only have been able to, but likely would have been obligated to consider entitlement to radiculopathy.
Is that the pre-VEMA duty to assist or that? I feel like we use the word jurisdiction incorrectly here, which is like, I understand NOD is a triggering. There's no duty to adjudicate anything that's not covered in NOD. That's fair enough. But like jurisdiction means you can't just sort of sometimes have jurisdiction or sometimes not. It's either you have the subject matter legal authority to enter. So how is it possible that they could rule in the first instance as to entitlement for radiculopathy, but not consider an NOD as to the effective date for the radiculopathy already assigned? Am I misunderstanding?
That would be the board's duty, as exists at every level of VA, to consider all issues that are reasonably raised within the claim. There would be no prejudice to appellant for the board making the initial decision of entitlement, because that would be implemented by the RO. And the appellant would then have the opportunity to challenge that RO decision as to whatever effective date and rating the RO assigned.
Okay.
As opposed to the board.
That is jurisdictional, right? I mean, jurisdiction is the legal capacity to entertain something.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. That's more as to the protections that are afforded to an appellant by this system. The jurisdiction...
I don't want to take us too far afield, but obviously reasonably raised stuff gets confusing. If you're saying the board has the right in the first instance to address anything reasonably raised by the record, I'm curious as to why you would even need an NOD at that point. You know, basically, the board can just read the record and just, okay, well, I see this, I see that, I can adjudicate entitlement. I just, that seems to me to kind of obviate the need for NODs at all.
Well, I think this is a unique circumstance as well, because Note 1 does provide this direction, again, regarding the initial scope of adjudication. This doesn't make the radiculopathy part and parcel of any pending spine condition. It simply means that when reviewing that spine condition, the initial entitlement to radiculopathy needs to be considered.
Do you agree that the veteran's radiculopathy rating arose from his request for an increased rating for his back disability?
That is what triggered the review that led to the grant. Yes, Your Honor.
And so how does that not cover them by the original NOD? That's the NOD that put this claim in appellate status. It had gone to the board, come back.
Your Honor, this goes back to Grantham and the fact that an unadjudicated downstream issue cannot be placed into appellate status by an NOD.
What is the downstream issue that you...
The downstream issue would be the effective date here, because the appellant asserts that the board had jurisdiction to review the effective date. Even if it could be said that the NOD were somehow to have conferred jurisdiction over the issue of entitlement to radiculopathy, the Federal Circuit was explicit that an NOD addressing the upstream issue of entitlement is not sufficient to confer jurisdiction for a downstream element such as effective date or rating.
And again, I just have to ask this question. The June 2021 board decision was a result of what appeal by the appellant? What was the board responding to?
The appellant's NOD, the appellant seeking an increased rating for the spine disability.
And
the NOD that placed the spine disability into
the process. NOD dated, dated when?
February 2009, I think. Isn't that right?
Is that what we're talking about?
Believe that NOD... I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So a lot happened in between then. The February, the February 09 to June 21, a lot of different examinations took place.
Yes, Your Honor. And as Appellant's counsel noted, there are other conditions that were in appellate status as well. It's the radiculopathy in the spine claim that the court has directed the parties to address today. And Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. If there are any other questions, I will happily answer those. Otherwise, I ask if I may just close very briefly.
Okay, go ahead.
Your Honor, the court should hold that radiculopathy is not necessarily part and parcel of a claim for a spine condition, and should reiterate that its decision in Chavez is limited to the unique, specific, narrow facts of that case. The court should dismiss any appeal as to radiculopathy for lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Yeah. There was one question I wanted to ask, and I assume this is just a typo. But how do we reconcile the Secretary's arguments at page 20 and 21 of its brief? The argument one is, appellant fails to show clear prejudicial error in not addressing the radiculopathy argument. And then argument two is, remand is warranted for appellant's claim seeking higher ratings for her service-connected back condition and for an earlier effective date for radiculopathy.
That was as to the Secretary's initial brief, not the supplemental response, Your Honor.
Yes,
Your Honor. That, and the Secretary does apologize. The Secretary has conceded that remand of the spine condition is necessary here. The secretary did not intend to suggest that the radiculopathy issue should be remanded as well, as that would obviously be inconsistent with the secretary's assertion earlier in the brief. That is an error, and I do apologize to the court for that.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the secretary concedes that the board would have jurisdiction over entitlement to radiculopathy before that intervening rating decision. He also concedes that entitlement to radiculopathy arose from that back disability claim. Here, this is about entitlement for radiculopathy for the entire period on appeal, because the RO in its initial adjudication should have adjudicated radiculopathy. There was evidence of radiculopathy because it was in Mr. Hart's treatment notes. There was evidence because the DBQ, which was obtained as part of VA's duty to assist, specifically investigated for evidence of radiculopathy. And because the regulation told the RO to consider neurological manifestations. The RO also should have adjudicated radiculopathy because 3.155 says that the RO needs to adjudicate complications. It did not. And so Mr. Hart challenged that rating that was assigned. When the RO did eventually grant the separate rating, she was told that it was a partial grant. And so rightfully, she did not file a new notice of disagreement because the board was already required to consider it. And the notice here is 4.71A, because the regulation tells adjudicators to consider neurological manifestations of a back disability. And that's intentional. If we look to the regulatory history, it shows that VA did this intentionally. In the regulatory history for the version of the regulation that added note one to the diagnostic code, VA was asked, why don't you just add specific neurological manifestations to this specific diagnostic code? Why not address it specifically? And VA came back and said, we already have diagnostic codes that consider and rate for these issues. And so because of that, we're going to add note one to direct adjudicators to consider it. So this was a very intentional move from VA to point adjudicators to the other diagnostic codes to rate the neurological manifestations, even in evaluating that initial back disability. Additionally, this is not a separate claim. The RO adjudicated the increased rating for Mr. Hart's back disability. She had notice of it, and so she challenged it in her February 2009 notice of disagreement. And at that time, again, the record had raised evidence of radiculopathy. And again, when the RO did eventually specifically adjudicate entitlement to ratings for radiculopathy, they told her that it was a partial grant, and so she did not appeal it. And so because of that, Your Honors, the court should hold that the radiculopathy claim was part of Mr. Hart's increased rating for a back disability claim and remand for the board to consider whether separate ratings are required prior to the period of 2019.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel, for both of your arguments. This case will be submitted, and we are now dismissed.